All right, this is Bio 241. It's Thursday, December 3rd, and I just want to remind you all that the next test, which is exam 5, sometimes we call it the final because it's the last exam, but it's not cumulative. It's just going to be over the last three chapters that we've covered, is on December 15th. That's a week from Tuesday, all right, or 2 weeks from Tuesday of this week. So December 15th. And it's going to be from 10:30 to 12:30, and I presume it's in this room. It's got to be in this room. Okay, yeah, thank you. Yeah, so you got 2 hours, but it's just a regular kind of test, so you'll be done, and, you know, if typically you get done in a half hour, you'll be done in a half hour, and that's about it. The only other thing I want to make sure that you all know is make sure that your lab grades are correct, right? All kinds of errors can creep into the lab grades reported by your lab instructor. Some lab instructors drop a low quiz. Make sure they drop the low quiz, not the high quiz by accident. Okay? I mean, it all happens, right? Because we all just make mistakes. And then just double check that. So in January or February, we don't have to walk around and get the dean's signature and the vice president's signature and my signature and some other people's signature to change your grade, right? So now is the time to do that. So you should all know how to contact your lab instructor. And they should be available through finals week if you have questions about the class or your grade. So don't feel bad about contacting the lab instructors because they get paid for that week. Okay? Somebody had a question. So three chapters. Yeah. So I need to get going so we can finish up respiratory chapter. Okay? Okay? All right, so we're talking about control of ventilation. Some of this is a little surprising. All right, a little surprising. The Autonomic Control Center for Hemodynamics is in the brain stem, like the medulla and the pons. And the Autonomic Control Center, like the Cardioregulatory Center is there, the Vasomotor Center is there, as well as the Respiratory Center is in the pons and the medulla. All right, so breathing is automatic. You don't have to be conscious to breathe as long as you have a healthy pons and medulla. Some people do get tumors or strokes in the medulla and the pons or other metabolic disorders, and then they can no longer breathe automatically. Every breath they take has to be a voluntary effort. And, of course, they don't have any kind of voluntary response when they're asleep. So when they fall asleep, they have to be hooked up to a ventilator, or else what happens? What happens if you fall asleep and stop breathing? Well, I suppose, but you'll probably wake up gasping for air, right? Just feeling like you're really out of breath, and so you can't sleep. So you have to be hooked up to a ventilator. That's called Odin's curse, by the way. So hopefully nobody in here will ever end up with something like that. So we're interested in these centers right here that control the autonomic or automatic functions for breathing. It consists of the rhythmicity center that we have here in the medulla. And there are inspiratory neurons that trigger inspiration. And what muscle is your primary muscle for inspiration? The diaphragm, right? Causes the diaphragm to contract. And there are expiratory neurons that cause exhalation by inhibiting the inspiratory neurons. And when they're inhibited, when you're just breathing quietly, right, the diaphragm relaxes. And when it relaxes, what happens? You expire, right? You just exhale air passively. You don't need muscle contraction when you're to expire when you're breathing quietly, right? So these inhibitory neurons allow for expiration to take place. All right, but this respiratory center or rhythmicity center is influenced by two other centers that are in the pons, the pneumotaxic area and the apneustic area. Okay, I guess I talked about this slide already. But here are the functions of the apneustic and pneumotaxic center that are in the pons. The apneustic center promotes inspiration by stimulating the rhythmicity center, especially the inspiratory neurons. Right, so the apneustic center helps set the rhythm of inspiration. The pneumotaxic center, on the other hand, I got to get this straightened out with the arrow before I go nuts. Okay. The pneumotaxis center, on the other hand, antagonizes the apneustic center, inhibiting inspiration. All right, so you need all of these centers working together in antagonistic ways to maintain a rhythmic rate of breathing. Okay, there are other things that can influence the respiratory center, namely the chemical composition inside your body. All right, and what kind of receptor do you need to measure chemicals? Chemoreceptors. So there are chemoreceptors in basically two areas. Right, there are central chemoreceptors that we have in the medulla. They're closely associated with the respiratory center. All right, and then there are peripheral chemoreceptors. And there are two locations for peripheral receptors. Just like baroreceptors, there are some in the aortic arch, and there are some in the carotid sinus. All right, so the ones in the carotid sinus are called the carotid bodies. The ones in the aortic arch are called the aortic bodies. All right, so these are all chemoreceptors. And the kinds of chemicals that they measure are carbon dioxide, oxygen, and pH. So those are the three kinds of compounds that they measure. And you might realize that some of these are related to each other by an enzymatic reaction. All right, so without studying respiratory physiology, which one of these chemicals do you think plays the most role in regulating your respiration? Which one of these chemicals right here is most important for maintaining homeostasis in your body? Okay, some of you are fairly sophisticated and you said CO2, but that's not my obvious answer. Okay, my obvious answer when I was just beginning to study this stuff was oxygen, because what's oxygen necessary for? ATP production, right? Cellular respiration, aerobic respiration. So I thought that was the key molecule, but the key molecule really is CO2, the byproduct of cellular respiration. All right, so we're going to focus our attention on carbon dioxide. And this P right here just stands for partial pressure of carbon dioxide, which is kind of like concentration of carbon dioxide. All right, but don't forget it's a gas that's dissolved in the fluids of your body. All right, so here you have the rhythmicity center in the medulla oblongata. And it can be influenced by the pons via the apneustic and pneumotaxic center, changing the rate and depth of inspiration. But you also have these chemoreceptors that send information to the medulla oblongata. And then the medulla oblongata is what? The integration center that can add all of these influences up and then make a decision on what to do for breathing, for automatic breathing. That will send efferent signals to the diaphragm. And the origin of the phrenic nerve is what? C3, 4, and 5. And then that constitutes the phrenic nerve that goes all the way to the motor neurons to the diaphragm. Okay. And this system right here can be overridden by what? Voluntary breathing. You can forcefully hyperventilate if you want. You can forcefully stop breathing if you want. You can hold your breath until you pass out. Raise your hand if we have any volunteers. Any volunteers in here? I know some of you have done that when you're little kids. Okay, but that's not such a big deal, all right? Because when you stop breathing voluntarily and you pass out, what takes over? This other system over here, this other pathway takes over, and then you start to breathe automatically, all right, via the rhythmicity center in the medulla oblongata. So sometimes little kids will play a little trick on their parents. They get really ticked off. They'll hold their breath until you pass out. But you shouldn't freak out because they'll pass out and then start breathing again. You're smiling. Why, did you do that a lot when you were a little kid? Okay. But you don't have to volunteer today for that. All right, so the chemical compound that we're most interested in is carbon dioxide, all right, because that's the byproduct of aerobic respirations. All right, nonetheless, chemoreceptors can modify ventilation to maintain normal levels of CO2, oxygen, and pH, or acidity in the body. And PCO2 is the most crucial because of its effect on pH of your body. And remember, pH is tightly regulated. It has to be tightly regulated to maintain homeostasis. the rates of enzyme reactions change, protein conformation changes with pH pretty drastically, right? And all that relates to function. All right, so if CO2 builds up in your body, it can combine with water to make carbonic acid, and then carbonic acid dissociates into hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. Right, and this, the delta G, the free energy change, is basically zero in this reaction right here. So that means that it is, look at these zeros right here. If the delta G is zero from reactants to products or products to reactants, right, what can you tell me about these zeros right here? They're two-way. Yeah, it can go backwards and forwards, right? So when CO2 builds up in the body, what else builds up? Hydrogen ions build up. Because of why? What would you use, what would you invoke to explain how hydrogen ions build up in the body when CO2 builds up? Yeah, that is Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action, right? So, and if CO2 declines, what happens to hydrogen ion concentration? It declines as well. It forces the reaction in the reverse direction. All right, so the way that we talk about carbon dioxide, so if carbon dioxide is changing, then the hydrogen ion concentration inside your body is changing as well. So this is a pretty handy reaction, and there's an enzyme that catalyzes this reaction. I'm sure you were tested on this already. What was the name of that enzyme? That catalyzes the interconversion of carbon dioxide and carbonic acid. That's called carbonic anhydrase, and here it is right here. Okay, so hyperventilation, when you exhale very rapidly, that means that you are losing a lot of CO2 from your body. Okay, you're forcing the loss of CO2. We call that hypocapnia. All right, so hyperventilation is hypocapnia. CO2 levels go down, and what's the effect of pH in your body? Okay, what happens to hydrogen ion? Yeah, increases, very good. As hydrogen ion concentration goes down, the pH increases. Remember, there, because of that equation you had to work with, it goes the opposite way. So it produces what we call an alkalosis. When you hyperventilate, that produces a respiratory alkalosis because you're losing these hydrogen ions. Hypoventilation causes you to retain carbon dioxide, and that's what we call hypercapnia. And as you retain carbon dioxide, what happens to the pH of your body? It decreases because these hydrogen ions increase. So that produces a respiratory acidosis. So just by adjusting the rate of your ventilation or breathing, you can affect changes in pH. Okay. So the effects of blood PCO2 on pH and ventilation. Here you have a nice response loop. So let's start with, what does the response loop always start with? A, stimulus, all right? So if you have decreased ventilation, like you're holding your breath, for instance, that increases arterial PCO2, so let's consider that the stimulus increasing arterial PCO2. What's the effect going to be on blood pH? You will become more acidic, right? So the pH is going to drop. That's going to stimulate the chemoreceptors in the aorta and the carotid sinus, and that's going to send signals to the respiratory center in the medulla, so that's the afferent pathway. Here's the integration center with the set point. And the respiratory center will then make a decision and send information out the phrenic nerve to the inspiratory muscles, namely the diaphragm, to increase ventilation. And as you increase ventilation, what happens to the concentration or partial pressure of carbon dioxide in your body? It will decrease, right? So that subtracts from the stimulus, so that's a nice negative feedback loop. Okay, there's something else that will happen too. Remember, there are two places where you have chemoreceptors. You have them centrally in the carotid sinus and aortic arch, but you also have them in the medulla oblongata as well. And actually, these are the most sensitive for changes in carbon dioxide. So as arterial PCO2 increases, the amount of CO2 in plasma increases, the CO2 can actually go across the blood-brain barrier, and once it's inside the brain, because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction, that's going to cause a decreased pH or an increase of what, acidity of the brain, the interstitial fluid, and that will be monitored by the chemoreceptors in the medulla, and that will be a powerful stimulator for the inspiratory neurons in the respiratory center, right? And you will start to hyperventilate, and that will bring your PCO2 back down to normal. All right, so it's important to know the coupling of carbon dioxide and pH, right, due to that carbonic anhydrase reaction. We're going to use that again a couple times in this chapter. All right, so the central chemoreceptors, meaning what? The brain. Remember, the nervous system can be broken down into two main areas. What are the two main areas? Brain and spinal cord, that's kind of a lower distinction, lower level. What's the most basic distinction? Central and peripheral, right? So central is brain and spinal cord. Peripheral is what? Outside the body. So that's how we talk about these receptors as well. Central meaning inside the brain, peripheral out in the periphery. Okay. So because hydrogen ions are charged, they can't cross the blood-brain barrier, but CO2 can. Right, it can pass through the phospholipid bilayer, right? And so this is why it has the greatest effects, right? The rate and depth of ventilation is adjusted to maintain arterial PCO2 at about 40 millimeters of mercury. So I want you to kind of be a little bit familiar with this number, because we're going to use this number when we look at a couple graphs coming up in the future. All right, so a good normal level of PCO2 is about 40 millimeters of mercury, and that's a pressure, right? That's just a pressure. Right, the peripheral chemoreceptors do not respond to PCO2, but only to levels of pH. All right, so let's look at this little graphic right here. So as tissue metabolism increases, producing a lot of CO2, CO2 builds up in the plasma. And if it's in the plasma, it can diffuse across this blood-brain barrier, right, including the cerebral spinal fluid, right, and then it will move into the brain. Hydrogen ions, on the other hand, can't cross this barrier, even if there is something that I'm going to ask you right now, right? What is the motive force for moving carbon dioxide from the blood into the brain right here? How does it get in there? You could think maybe of either that pressure gradient or concentration gradient. You could actually think of the partial pressure as like being a concentration of those molecules. Right, but because there is that difference in pressure or concentration, these molecules will go from what? A high level to low level, so these diffuse. So the correct term is diffuse into the brain. But inside the brain, you also have carbonic anhydrase. Carbonic anhydrase takes the CO2 and produces what? Hydrogen ions. And these hydrogen ions then directly stimulate the chemoreceptors, which will stimulate inspiration. All right, so don't forget, this hydrogen ion can't get into the brain because of the blood-brain barrier, but CO2 can, and that's not such a big deal because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction. Okay, so most of your ventilatory drive is controlled by carbon dioxide, which then can be converted into hydrogen ions in the brain. Okay, not oxygen. But oxygen can play a role under some circumstances, right? You would like to have high oxygen concentration in your body to drive respiration to make ATP. All right, so low blood PO2 is what we call hypoxemia, right? So that you're moving away from homeostasis, but it has little effect on ventilation. The most powerful chemical, don't forget, is carbon dioxide. Right, but it can influence the chemoreceptor sensitivity to carbon dioxide. But lowering oxygen concentrations will have a significant effect if there's a drastic change. If there's a drastic reduction in oxygen, it can become a powerful stimulator for inspiration. Right, but that's only at the point where your brain almost cannot maintain metabolism, can't maintain consciousness because oxygen is so low. And that's what we call hypoxic drive. When the oxygen concentration is so low, okay, then that will be a powerful stimulator for inspiration, but it's drastically, drastically low. All right, so I can relate this to a circumstance where some divers can get into a lot of trouble. Did I mention this in class already to you guys? I think maybe I did. When I talk about free divers that like to go fishing out in the ocean, and instead of wearing scuba tanks, they don't take air with them, right? They just dive under the surface of the water, and they can swim down to like 30 feet below the surface and hunt for fish with a spear gun and things like that. Okay? And so when somebody does that, they don't want to have the urgency to breathe, because it's no fun to be down 30 feet underwater and then feeling like you're running out of breath. You're going to have a tendency to breathe. So what is the chemical that gives you the urgency to breathe, the one that is the most sensitive? That's what we just talked about. CO2, okay? So before you dive, and you can do this if you want to swim underwater, if you want to swim laps underneath the pool, sometimes, right, when we're kids, we'll say, well, how many laps can you swim underwater? And somebody would say, oh, I can do it 2 times. And then what do you say? Oh, that's nothing. I can do it 4 times. So how is it that you can do it for a longer period of time? Well, you can deplete your body of CO2. And how could you get rid of CO2 in your body? By hyperventilating, right? So take a lot of deep breaths in a hurry. You get rid of a lot of CO2, right? And so now, when you hold your breath, you can hold your breath for a lot longer period of time because you basically have no CO2 in your body, right? So it takes longer for it to build up. So you can hold your breath for a lot longer period of time. All right, but if you're using aerobic respiration to make ATP, which of course you have to do to maintain consciousness, what's happening to oxygen concentration? Even though you don't feel like you have to take a breath, what's happening to oxygen concentration? It's decreasing, right? Because you're using it up to make ATP. But you don't have that urgency to breathe. So what free divers get into trouble sometimes is that they hyperventilate to an extreme, don't have any CO2 in their body or very low levels. They dive down really deep in the ocean. Okay, they don't experience any urgency to breathe because CO2 hasn't built back up to the physiologic concentrations or above physiologic concentrations. But what's happening to their oxygen? Decreasing, decreasing, and decreasing. And it gets to a certain point that there's not enough oxygen in their body to make ATP. And what's one of the most sensitive organs? Is your brain, and you pass out. And that's really unfortunate, because what would happen to you if you pass out and you're 20 feet underwater? Okay, you can no longer hold your breath, you start to hyperventilate, there's no air to breathe, and you drown as a result of that. So those free divers have to be really careful and practice, because that onset of loss of consciousness, the onset is very rapid, right? And so that could be dangerous. So that's kind of an interesting everyday experience, maybe not for everybody in here, of the importance of understanding this physiology and how it affects a lot of people's lives. So here is just a graph that shows that, all right? A comparison of sensitivity, basically, to the partial pressure of CO2 and PO2 effects of ventilation. So let's take a look at this graph. Here we have basically the rate of ventilation on the vertical scale versus concentration of either oxygen on the horizontal scale on the bottom or the concentration of carbon dioxide on the vertical scale on the top. All right, but notice that these scales are reversed, right? Because ventilation is going to be stimulated by CO2 as it increases, right? But what about oxygen? Ventilation is going to be stimulated as oxygen decreases, not increases. So the scale is just reversed for you to pay attention to. All right, what is that, brown or red? Red, the red line, that's nice it's red, is when CO2 changes, if oxygen is held constant, all right? And this shows how the ventilation increases as carbon dioxide increases, right? It's directly related to each other. Right, the blue line right here, you know, unless it's purple or something, this blue line shows how ventilation increases as oxygen decreases. So which line, all right, starts to move sooner and faster as either CO2 or oxygen changes? It is CO2. So CO2 by far, right, is a more powerful stimulator for ventilation or inspiration compared to oxygen. It's only when oxygen decreases, right, almost to zero before it has a significant effect on inspiration, right? Most of your body relies on CO2. All right, so that's pretty much the point I wanted to make. CO2 is monitored and is much more sensitive for adjusting ventilation in your body. All right, your lungs are pretty delicate tissue. Maybe you've done some dissections, okay? And it is possible to overinflate a lung, and when a lung is overinflated, it can rupture. And so there are mechanisms in your body to prevent overinflation of a lung so that it doesn't damage itself, and that's called the Herring-Brewer reflex. All right, it's mediated by stretch receptors in the lungs. Right, so as the lungs start to inflate, the stretch receptors send more and more action potentials to the rhythmicity center in the medulla, and that inhibits the inspiratory neurons. And when the inspiratory neurons are inhibited, that prevents overinflation of the lungs. All right, so know something about that Herring-Brewer reflex. It prevents overinflation of the lungs. All right, let's talk about how certain compounds are carried by the blood. All right, and of course, we need oxygen in our tissues for aerobic respiration. And we have red blood cells that do the job for us. All right, and it's not just the cells, but there's a special chemical compound inside cells called hemoglobin that can bind a tremendous amount of oxygen. So we're interested in the loading of hemoglobin with oxygen, right, and in the lungs, and unloading of that oxygen in tissues, because we want to deliver oxygen from the lungs to the tissues. All right, and so we're going to look at how the affinity for oxygen changes on hemoglobin under a number of physiologic conditions, like maybe changes in pH, changes in temperature. All right, so we're going to look at some of these effects. All right, so here we have a hemoglobin molecule, and we see that it takes four protein chains to make up a hemoglobin molecule, and in the center of each of those chains is an iron, right? And that's a ferrous iron, and so that's able to bind one oxygen molecule. So one hemoglobin can actually bind four different oxygen molecules. All right, so let's look and see how hemoglobin changes the transport of oxygen in the blood. All right, so let's just take some plasma right here without any red blood cells in it. And we're going to bubble oxygen through this plasma until it reaches, if we actually take this gas tank right here with a PO2 of 100 millimeters of mercury, and that's basically what it is in the alveoli inside of our lungs. So this would be a good example of what's happening inside your lungs. All right, then this is going to equilibrate with the plasma to where the PO2 is going to be the same as this air right here. It's going to have a PO2 of 100 millimeters of mercury. And if we now measure, right, the volume of oxygen that's dissolved in plasma, it turns out to be 0.3 milliliters for every 100 mLs of plasma. That would be like the concentration in percent of oxygen that's contained in this plasma right here. And that's probably not enough to keep us alive. But oxygen can bind to hemoglobin. When it does, we call that oxyhemoglobin. Oxyhemoglobin is transporting oxygen in our bodies. And in every red blood cell, there's almost 300 million molecules of hemoglobin. That's a pretty high number, right? And so then how many molecules of oxygen can each red blood cell contain? It would be 4 times 300 million, which is what? 1.2 trillion molecules of oxygen in one red blood cell. So that's pretty amazing. That's almost like a proposed budget for the state of California. Okay? So that's good. All right, so let's now, instead of just having pure plasma right here, let's put some red blood cells, some whole blood, with a normal kind of hematocrit of maybe about 45%, so we're not super packing this blood sample with a lot of red blood cells, just a typical number of red blood cells, and we're still going to bubble oxygen through it so that in solution, the partial pressure of oxygen is going to be 100 millimeters of mercury, the same as just with plasma. But now all of those trillions of oxygen molecules can bind to hemoglobin, right? And that's going to subtract, that's not going to add to the partial pressure. These red blood cells are just going to carry oxygen. And then if we take all the oxygen out of the red blood cells and measure it, we get 20 milliliters for every 100 milliliters of blood. So you can see the big change is what? Almost a factor of 100 compared to if there's no hemoglobin in the solution right here. So hemoglobin is a marvelous compound that can change the amount of oxygen that's carried by the blood by about a factor of 100. All right, so that's really nice to know, even though the partial pressure is exactly the same because it's bound to that hemoglobin molecule. All right, there can be other forms of hemoglobin. All right, there's always going to be a little bit of methemoglobin. It contains a ferric iron instead of the ferrous. The ferrous is a plus 2 right here, so this is the oxidized form. All right, it lacks that necessary oxygen, the electron to bind oxygen. And all blood normally contains a little bit of this kind of compound right here. Another kind of hemoglobin is when it binds to carbon monoxide. What's the chemical formula for carbon monoxide? Yeah, just CO. Let's see if I got a marker. Ooh, I'm really low on markers right here. CO. Good enough. That's carbon monoxide. It can bind to hemoglobin. It binds at the exact same position that oxygen does, but unfortunately for us, all right, this carbon monoxide, and let's just say this is hemoglobin that's bound to carbon monoxide, has a much higher affinity for hemoglobin than does oxygen. And the factor is about 210. It has a higher affinity by a factor of about 210, so who can tell me something about where does this carbon monoxide come from? What produces carbon monoxide? Our bodies might produce a little bit of side reactions, but not very much. It's usually by combustion, right? Burning of any kind of fuel, like candles produces carbon monoxide, charcoal briquettes, right? Gasoline, see me after class. Okay. Gasoline, right? Even if we burn wood or whatever, it's going to produce carbon monoxide because it's an incomplete combustion. We have more complete combustion in our bodies because we have enzymes ruling chemical reactions. But anytime you burn anything, that produces carbon monoxide. When you burn gasoline in a car, for instance, that's one of the byproducts. Okay. So because it has such a high affinity for hemoglobin, and because it is colorless, and because it is odorless, you can't tell when you're breathing carbon monoxide and it's binding up hemoglobin. So it's actually very, very deadly. So because the affinity is so high, there might be extremely low levels of carbon monoxide in the environment, but if it stays at a low level for a long period of time, it still binds up a lot of hemoglobin in your red blood cells, and it can be lethal because when carbon monoxide is bound to hemoglobin, then oxygen can't bind to it, and oxygen isn't being delivered to your tissues. So that's like somebody choking you without that physical effect. Okay. So if we have this hemoglobin right here, we can get it to come off, right? There is an antidote for this, right? We can treat somebody with carbon monoxide poisoning. What do we have to do? We have to give them an atmosphere that's really high in oxygen in order to just displace this one carbon monoxide. So if I was going to get this carbon monoxide off hemoglobin right here, how many oxygen molecules would I have to draw here? What's the factor? 210. I would have to draw in 210 oxygen molecules before I have just an even distribution, half, right, carbon monoxide and half bound with oxygen. All right, so that just shows you, gives you an example of how powerful. Not an intoxicant, but it is toxic for you, right? Very, very low levels are lethal as a result. And unfortunately, like around this time of year, a lot of people die of carbon monoxide poisoning because maybe some furnaces stop working correctly. When you burn gas in your house, it usually should go up the chimney or a flue, And sometimes somebody moves into the flue over the summertime, like a squirrel or a raccoon or something. And people turn on their furnace right before they go to bed, and the family never wakes up in the morning as a result. That happens usually once or twice in L.A. during the year, or in Southern California. And there was a very famous professional tennis player who was ranked number one in the world, died in New York City because of that. Probably you guys don't remember, it was probably before you were born. But who was that? Somebody said his name. That was, yeah, Vitas Gerulaitis. Sounds like a disease, but that was a guy's name. Okay. So bottom line is, if your furnace isn't working, don't bring a heater into your house to warm your house up, right? Like a hibachi or something, because it's going to produce carbon monoxide. You'll be warm, but not for very, very long. Oh, yeah, it's a very efficient way of committing suicide as well. Yeah. Right. Okay, so let's look at the binding a little bit more sophisticated way. Let's look at the binding of oxygen to hemoglobin and how it changes with different physiologic states. And so we're going to make a plot using this data right here of PO2 versus percent oxyhemoglobin. So the amount of hemoglobin that's bound to oxygen, right? So you could plot this out, and it's going to look something like this. So we have a plot of percent oxyhemoglobin saturation, right? From the hemoglobin not saturated with oxygen at all until what? It's completely saturated with oxygen versus the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood. And we can also look at oxygen content over here because it relates to oxygen saturation in the blood. And what can you tell me about the relationship between the partial pressure of oxygen and the percent saturation? As oxygen concentration or the pressure increases, what happens to the oxygen content or percent oxygen saturation? It increases. They're directly related to each other, right? But it's not just a straight line. It's kind of this sigmoid curve right here. Okay. So let's look at the partial pressure of oxygen. In arteries, we said it's about 100, right? Because that's about what it is in the alveoli, and that diffuses into the blood in the capillaries of the pulmonaries, right? So then that oxygen is delivered to tissues, and it can't diffuse out of veins or arteries, it can only diffuse out of capillaries, right, because they're the thinnest. Right, so oxygen will diffuse out into the tissues, and when we look at the PO2 in veins, it's about 40 millimeters of mercury. So the change is what? 60 millimeters of mercury right here. But let's look at the percent saturation. Okay, at 100 millimeters of mercury, what is the saturation? Pretty close to 100%, right? But as the PO2 decreases to 40, what is the saturation on hemoglobin? It drops to 70, 75, right? So the amount of oxygen that's delivered to the tissues is just this difference right here on the vertical scale, which is what? Which is about 25 or 30 millimeters of mercury of oxygen delivered to the tissues because of the way that it binds to hemoglobin. Okay. But we know that pH can change in tissues depending on activity level. Like, for instance, if you have a muscle and you start exercising it, and what is one of the byproducts of exercise in muscles? Like a lactic acid. So the pH is going to decrease. It's going to become more acidic. It's going to decrease. So here we can see, okay, normal pH is about 7.4, 7.6, that's an increase, so that's not during exercise, but 7.2 is becoming more acidic, like what we would see under exercising kinds of conditions. All right, so let's look and see what happens to that oxygen binding curve as we change the pH. So I'm not so interested in telling you these numbers, I'd rather look at a table. All right, so here we have that same kind of curve that shows percent oxygen saturation versus PO2, right? And here it is at 7.6, that's under the normal conditions, right? And so arterial supply is about 100 millimeters of mercury, and it's 40 right here coming back to the heart through this vein, right? So this is the oxygen delivery under normal conditions. But look what happens to this dissociation curve as the body becomes acidic and even more acidic. So let's just look at this extreme case of if the pH were to drop down to 7.2. All right, so the arterial PO2 would still be 100. The percent saturation really isn't 100 anymore, but it's well up into the 90s, right? 94, 95. But now let's go to the PO2 of 40, which is what we would find in the venous return to the heart. And what's the percent saturation? Look, it has dropped way down to 60, right? So this is the amount of oxygen now that's being delivered to the tissues, which is more like what? 35 or 40% being unsaturated, right? Or being delivered to the tissues. So there's much more delivery of oxygen to the tissues as the pH decreases. And so that should sort of make sense to you. As a tissue becomes more metabolic, as the pH drops, because of the way that hemoglobin binds oxygen, it actually delivers more oxygen to the tissues when it needs it, for instance, like during exercise. Does that sort of make sense to you? You might have to look at this curve maybe over the weekend or something. All right, but under normal conditions, we're going from here to here. But under high pH conditions, we're going from here, the unloading, all the way down to here. Much more oxygen is unloading from hemoglobin. So which way do these curves shift? This is kind of, I think, the take-home message that I want you to be able to use to figure some of this out. Which way did this curve shift? Going from a normal pH to a lower pH, and when it goes to this lower pH, you get more dissociation of oxygen in the tissues, more oxygen delivery. Which way does this curve shift? Does it curve up? Did it shift up? Did it shift down? Did it shift to the left or to the right? To the right. Yeah, that's what we call the right shift. Okay? And this is also what we call the Bohr effect. All right, so the Bohr effect causes the binding curve for oxyhemoglobin to shift to the right. And when it shifts to the right, does that deliver more or less oxygen to tissues? That's really the take-home message. It delivers more oxygen to the tissues. All right, so anytime the oxygen saturation curve shifts to the right, you're going to say more delivery of oxygen to tissues. If it shifts to the left, it's less delivery of oxygen in the tissues. All right, let's look at a couple other circumstances. All right, there is a chemical compound called 2,3-DPG, diphosphoglycerate, and that's a modified compound that is used in glycolysis. So sometimes we call it a glycolytic intermediate. You didn't have to memorize all the little chemicals that made up glycolysis, but you know something about glycolysis, right? If I say glycolysis, that's the really old way to make ATP, not very efficient, right? So, but 2,3-DPG is a three-carbon molecule, right? If you cut glucose into two parts, you can make 2,3-DPG. This 2,3 right here means that there's a phosphate at these two positions on that three-carbon molecule. All right, so if, for instance, you're at high altitude, the partial pressure of oxygen decreases. Anybody live at high altitude? Where are some cities that are at a high altitude?
Denver
is really high. That's what? A mile high city. It's 5,000 feet above us. 5,200 and some feet above LA. All right, so that's pretty far up in the sky. How about Mexico City, Lima, Peru? A lot of places that are way up in the mountains. Okay? And if there is, because of high altitude, low partial pressure of oxygen, right, there's less oxyhemoglobin, right, because now you don't have 100 millimeters of mercury in the alveolus anymore because there just isn't that much oxygen in the atmosphere, right, so when that happens, there's going to be less inhibition in the production of this molecule, 2,3-DPG, which means that it's going to increase inside the cells. So red blood cells actually are kind of loaded with 2,3-DPG diphosphoglycerate. And when 2,3-DPG increases, that lowers the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen. It lowers the affinity. So it shifts to the right. And when it shifts to the right, what about oxygen delivery to tissues? Whenever you shift something to the right, remember, shifting to the right, you get more oxygen delivery to the tissue. So as 2,3-DPG increases, you get increased O2 unloading in the tissues. So when somebody is living at a high altitude, one of the physiologic responses is that their red blood cells produce more of this 2,3-DPG so that more oxygen is delivered to their tissues. All right, and how does that correlate, or how does that response relate to this initial stimulus right here? It subtracts, right? So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism that's maintaining oxygen delivery homeostasis to the tissues. So 2,3-DPG increases oxygen delivery. All right, but there are three effects that I want you to know. We talked about pH. As pH decreases, it shifts the curve to the right. All right, as you move up in altitude, 2,3-DPG increases, that shifts the curve to the right. But let's look at temperature. You might have a plot in your book, but we can just look at it on this table right here. As temperature increases, that decreases the affinity, that shifts the curve to the right. And what does that do for oxygen delivery? As your body temperature increases, what does that do for oxygen delivery in the tissues? It increases oxygen delivery to the tissues. And under what circumstances might your body temperature increase? How about when you start to contract muscles? The dreaded exercise word, okay? As you exercise, and what do your tissues need when you're exercising? More oxygen or less oxygen? More oxygen, so I think you can appreciate the evolutionary significance of how the oxygen binding curve shifts to the right, delivering more oxygen to the tissues under exercise when your temperature increases, when your pH decreases, all right? So that's really nice and beneficial, okay? I don't think I have time to talk about sickle cell anemia today. Maybe if I have time. Okay. All right, let's talk about CO2 transport. So how is oxygen transported in the blood? Mostly bound to hemoglobin. You got to have that hemoglobin in there. So it doesn't count if you have red blood cells, right? You need to have red blood cells with hemoglobin, all right, in order to transport oxygen. Carbon dioxide is quite a bit different, all right? Carbon dioxide can diffuse from tissues that are producing it into the plasma, all right? 10% of the CO2 can dissolve by itself in plasma. So that's it. The plasma by itself can carry a fair amount of CO2. CO2 dissolves into water very, very nicely. But still, that's a far cry from 100%, all right? The remainder will diffuse into red blood cells down a concentration gradient and combine with hemoglobin to form carbaminohemoglobin, and that will account for another 20%, but it's not at the same site that oxygen binds to hemoglobin, so those hemoglobins still can transport oxygen, all right? So it doesn't interfere with oxygen transport because it's a different site. All right, but once that carbon dioxide is in a red blood cell, guess what can happen to it? Inside the red blood cell is carbonic anhydrase. And what does that do? That gobbles up carbon dioxide, right, combines with water to form carbonic acid, and then that makes hydrogen ions and bicarbonate. Right, these hydrogen ions right here can combine with hemoglobin, and that's going to what? Enhance unloading in the tissues, right, because that means the pH is decreasing. This bicarbonate will leave the cell. Bicarbonate is like a salt. How much salt can you put in water? Like if you have a shaker full of salt on your table and a big coffee mug, you could probably pour that whole shaker of salt into the coffee mug, and what's going to happen to it? Is it just all going to fall to the bottom and be a big rock down there? It's going to dissolve right in, right? So bicarbonate can dissolve in plasma very easily. So most of the carbon dioxide that's picked up by the blood, 70% of it is transported as a bicarbonate ion, right? And you can see because it's an ion, it's an electrolyte, it's what? Hydrophilic, it's a polar compound. It dissolves in water very, very easily, unlike oxygen itself. But as this anion moves out of the cell, there's got to be another anion to move into the cell to maintain electrical neutrality, namely this chloride right here. So this is what we call the chloride shift. So as tissues produce CO2, all right, red blood cells produce bicarbonate, and to replace that bicarbonate that's being transported in the blood, this chloride ion enters. So I think that's the bottom line. I would ask you on maybe a test, how is oxygen transported in the blood? Does it have to be converted into anything? No, it just binds to hemoglobin, right? And you could probably calculate how many hemoglobins or how many oxygens are transported by a typical red blood cell. And then I would ask you, how is carbon dioxide transported in the blood? The major way that carbon dioxide is transported. It's transported as bicarbonate ion, right? Because of the carbonic anhydrase reaction and because of the chloride shift, right? So two different methods, all right? And then that's just driven by Le Chatelier's principle. How much bicarbonate is produced right here depends on how much carbon dioxide is being produced in the tissue. If the tissues are producing a lot of CO2, what happens to bicarbonate levels? It goes up, right, because of Le Chatelier's principle. So this is in the tissues. Let's see, and where does this plasma end up? If your heart is beating, it goes from the tissues back to the heart, namely the right atrium into the right ventricle pumps it into the lungs, and voila, you have other structures there that allow for exchange, namely what? What kind of blood vessels are in the lungs that allow for exchange? There are capillaries right there. So let's look and see what happens in the capillaries of the lungs. This is the capillaries of systemic tissues. All right, so now we're in the lungs. And the CO2 in air is very, very low. It's basically zero, right? It's about 0.3, okay? And it's high in plasma. And CO2 will then diffuse down its concentration gradient from the blood into this alveolus, decreasing the concentration in plasma, all right, which then affects the amount that is bound to hemoglobin, because now there's a big concentration gradient from carbamamino hemoglobin, all right, so carbon dioxide dissociates from hemoglobin, diffuses into the plasma, and then diffuses into the air in the alveolus. All right, and if CO2 is leaving cells, what happens to this bicarbonate reaction or the carbonic anhydrase reaction? As CO2 is leaving the cell, diffusing into the alveolus, which way does this equation shift? Which way does this reaction shift? Right, is it going to shift to the right, or is it going to shift over to the left? Yeah, just due to Le Chatelier's principle. If CO2 goes away, then carbonic anhydrase reaction is going to take bicarbonate and make CO2 out of it, right? So bicarbonate decreases inside the cell, so that means there's a concentration gradient. Bicarbonate enters the red blood cell from the plasma, right? But that's an anion, so what has to happen? Another chloride has to leave to maintain electrical neutrality, and then that bicarbonate ends up as CO2, which then diffuses into this alveolus, and then you breathe it out of your body, okay? So the reverse reaction takes place. But nonetheless, don't forget the bottom line take-home message is, how is CO2 transported in the blood? Not really as CO2, but as that anion, the bicarbonate anion. Okay, so that's the last slide. Okay, all right, so that's respiratory system. So gain a little facility in understanding how oxygen is unloaded in the tissues by shifting the percent saturation curve. Know how oxygen is transported in the blood as opposed to carbon dioxide, so be familiar with that carbonic anhydrase reaction, right, the chloride shift, and probably you should know what the Bohr effect is. The Bohr effect is how the dissociation curve is shifted to the right as pH decreases, and that causes unloading of oxygen in the tissues. Okay, so that takes us to our last chapter. And let's see if I have it. Oh, let's look at this. Okay. But if I don't have it, could that be a good excuse? No. No, because it's online. Okay. Let me just look at what number two is right here. Hopefully there's some figures here that I left out. Ah, good. Okay, got them. Okay, so urinary system, chapter 17. Structure and function of the kidney. You're probably going to have to review most of that on your own if you've forgotten that from your anatomy. But I'll point out some of the salient features. All right, then we're going to look at some of these other factors right here. So kidney function. So you should know where the kidneys are, the four gross structures that make up the urinary system. Right, kidneys. What's next? Ureter. What's after that? Bladder. And then urethra. Okay. So that's some of the gross anatomy. But know something about the microscopic anatomy of the kidney as well, right? The pyramids and the columns and blood vessels and all that kind of stuff. All right. So the function of the kidney is to regulate plasma and also interstitial fluid by forming urine. So the kidney is going to produce urine. But in the process of making urine, right, in producing urine, the kidneys also regulate the volume of blood plasma. All right, so it regulates blood volume. So as your blood volume increases, what effect is that going to have on your physiology? In particular, your hemodynamics. As you lose blood volume, you have less venous return to the heart gets weaker, blood pressure decreases. So regulating blood pressure is a way, regulating fluid volume in your body is a way of regulating blood pressure. And that's brought about by that mechanism that we talked about already, which is the most important mechanism for regulating blood pressure in the long term. It requires hormones to do that. And that's what? The dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Okay? So I'm sure that's a diagram for you on the test. I didn't have that on the last test, right? No, that's this one coming up. So make sure you know that. We'll go over that again. All right, but it also removes waste products from the blood. And a good example of that would be urea. Urea contains a nitrogen atom, and it comes from ammonia, which comes from protein metabolism, in particular amino acid metabolism, and ammonia is very toxic. And the way that your body gets rid of ammonia is that it converts it into urea, and the kidneys can get rid of urea for you very efficiently, not so for ammonia. All right, so it removes waste products. It adjusts the concentration of various electrolytes in plasma, like sodium concentration and potassium bicarbonate and other kinds, including hydrogen ions. So it can regulate hydrogen ion concentration in the blood, right? And so it can adjust what? Plasma pH as well. All right, so these are all the functions of the kidney. All right, so you know all of this kind of stuff already, so I'm going to pass by these things right here. Microscopic structure of the kidney. So I have a question. What's the structural and functional unit of life? A cell. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction? Sarcomere. All right, it's coming, it's looking good. What about the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? The synapse, right? And so when you say that, you should have a nice picture in your mind of all the little components, right? So it's a very powerful way of thinking about these more complicated structures and relating it to their function. So we're going to look at the structural and functional unit of urine formation. What the heck is that thing called? Don't say sarcomere. Don't say synapse. Nobody did. You all are saying nephron. That is excellent. All right, so we need to focus on the nephron right here. Okay, and our kidneys have about 1 million nephrons. That's quite a big number. And there are basically two kinds of structures that make up a nephron. Anybody know the two general kind of categories that make up a structural components that make up a nephron? You have one and two right here. You have tubular elements, And I tell you what, if these things aren't on the tip of your tongue over the weekend, make sure you can fill this in. I don't necessarily want to take time today. Tubular elements. But the compound that we find in tubular elements is either something we call filtrate, or when it's processed, it becomes urine. Right? Those are the tubular elements in the nephron. The other kind of elements are, anybody know how I'm deconvolving this in my mind? You have the vascular elements. The vascular elements, and what do we have in a vascular element? You've got blood. Okay? So the nephron is an interaction between blood that is in, like, arterioles and capillaries, like the glomerulus is a capillary, and the tubular elements of the nephron. Okay, so what are some of these? I guess maybe I'll go over it really fast. All right. The way that something turns from filtrate to urine, okay, is a result of just three processes that we're going to look at. Just three simple processes, and we've got them here. Glomerular filtration is the first one. Tubular reabsorption is the second. And the third is tubular secretion. So what kind of... Here we have... Here are the tubular elements. You have them on your list. You don't have to copy that down. Okay, then here are the vascular elements. Right, so you should actually be able to draw that nephron out at this point in time. And it's going to look something like this. All right? All right, so maybe that looks like just a big jumbled mess for you right at the moment, but you got to have this down by Monday. All right, but maybe we'll just draw it out really quick right now. All right, as well as the three basic processes. We've got that marker and that marker. Are those different colors? Okay. All right, so let's draw in first the tubular elements. All right, tubular elements start with something called Bowman's capsule. All right, I think that's on your list, Bowman's capsule. All right, and then there's a tube coming out of Bowman's capsule. Inside Bowman's capsule, we have filtrate. And that filtrate leaves Bowman's capsule, and it goes into this tube like this. And it's not a straight tube. It has a lot of twists and turns in it. So what do we call that? That's a convoluted tubule. And since it's the first one to Bowman's capsule, this is what we call the proximal convoluted tubule. And then, remember, the kidney has got two main regions. The superficial layer of the kidney is called the, as opposed to the deeper layer. And it's true for any organ. Remember when we looked at the adrenal gland? Sorry. You got what? The cortex and then the medulla underneath it. So here is like the line of demarcation between the cortex and the medulla. All right. Then this tube moves from the cortex down into the medulla, dives down really deep. This is what we call the loop of Henle. Filtrate is moving in this direction, downward, coming out of the proximal convoluted tubule. So this is what? The descending loop of Henle. And then it comes back up into the cortex. So this is the ascending loop of Henle. And then here are some more convoluted tubules, no longer called the PCT. These are the distal convoluted tubules. All right. And in all of these tubules right here, you have filtrate. We're going to talk about what that is in just a second. And then after the distal convoluted tubule, that empties into a big tube called the collecting duct. Okay, and then someplace in the collecting duct, that fluid is no longer considered filtrate. It actually becomes urine. All right, so things are happening to this filtrate to produce urine, and we're going to look at those three processes in just a second, but what do we have to draw on here first before we talk about the processes? Yeah, the vascular elements, right? Vascular elements. All right, so there are big arteries that poke up into the cortex called the cortical radiate arteries. Maybe this is bringing back some spawn nightmares, I'm not sure. Cortical radiate arteries that poke up. And then off the cortical radiate arteries, there is an arteriole that's bringing blood into Bowman's capsule. And just like the nervous system, you have nerves that bring information into the CNS and nerves that bring information away. Those are called what? Afferent and efferent. So this is the afferent arteriole. And then there is a capillary in here, which is specialized for? Yeah, for exchange. But this is a special kind of capillary. It's a really leaky capillary. So it's not a continuous capillary. It's a fenestrated one. Hopefully that's reminding you of what a picture in your anatomy book, what a fenestrated capillary is. It means it has holes in the endothelium, so that a lot of plasma can leak out of this capillary into Bowman's capsule. Okay, so you have plasma leaking out from the capillary into Bowman's capsule, and that plasma, as it leaks out into the capsule, we call that filtrate. So filtrate is almost like plasma. All right, then the blood leaves. Some blood leaves. This is what we call the efferent arteriole. And here is something interesting about the kidney. There are not many places in the body where you have a portal circulation. What's a portal circulation compared to just the usual kind of circulation? Okay, think of this. Here you have a heart. What do we call a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart? Artery. So here's an artery. And then you got this thing here for exchange. What's that? That's a capillary. And then you have a vein. So that's a typical kind of circulatory pattern we see with just one capillary bed. But every once in a while, we're going to find a circulation in the body where there's one capillary and then that feeds directly a second capillary bed. And this vessel, typically, that's a what? That's a portal vessel. And that's a special delivery system. There's something special taking place. Can anybody name a portal circulation that they learned? Yeah, that's a really good one. Hepatic portal system, where in the intestines and stomach, for instance, toxic materials are absorbed, but that those toxic materials aren't delivered to the whole body. Before it gets to the whole body, it goes to the liver, where the liver can detoxify some of those compounds, and then the liver delivers blood to the inferior vena cava, right? So that's a special delivery system. Well, that's sort of like what we have here in the nephron. Maybe you're running out of ink. Let's get it going again. All right, so here we have the efferent arteriole, and instead of going back directly to the renal vein, it forms another capillary. And this capillary surrounds all of the tubes. The distal convoluted tubule, proximal convoluted tubule, even loop of Henle. All right, and so what's the function of these capillaries right here? What's the function of any kind of capillary? Exchange, right? So it can exchange stuff that's filtrate inside the tubular elements right here. All right, and then this is a venule, which then goes back to, well, we'll just say what? Renal vein right there. All right, so that is the nephron. And you should probably be able to draw that in less than a minute. Right, and if we have time right at the end of class, right, I can show you how to draw it in less than a minute. But let's not forget about those processes. How many processes are there? Yeah, three processes. Number one is filtration. Two is tubular reabsorption. And three is tubular secretion. So here we have that first process, number one, right? Filtration. Just due to hydrostatic pressure. The pressure in the capillary of the fluid there is higher than in Bowman's capsule, so fluid leaves the... Oh, I didn't write that down. I forgot. Holy cow. Don't you forget. What is this that capillary there? Oh, and I didn't tell you what the name of this capillary was. What's this capillary called? That's the glomerulus, right? That's the glomerulus. And then these capillaries are the peritubular capillaries. Peritubular, since they're around the tubes. Okay, so the first process, because of pressure difference, fluid is going to leave the plasma, end up in the filtrate. We call that filtration. Did I erase that? I thought I wrote it on the board. Maybe it's on the slide, your previous slide. Filtration. Okay, so that fluid leaves, and then that filtrate moves through the rest of the tubules right here. All right, and the basis of filtration is by the size of the molecule. I know it's kind of hard to see, just the size of the molecule. So water moves out. And I think there, during the course of a day, about 45 gallons of water move from your plasma into Bowman's capsule. Well, what would you be like if you lost 45 gallons? Well, you don't even have 45 gallons in your body. You would have, what, dehydrated hours and hours and hours ago, right? So we just need to consider that. So filtrate contains a lot of molecules that your body can't lose. Another molecule would be glucose. Glucose is small enough to be filtered. But is glucose, and if it's in the filtrate, where is it going to end up? In urine, and you're going to lose it from your body. Now, do you want to lose glucose? What's glucose good for? Cellular respiration, making ATP, right? So you can't afford to lose glucose. All right, but nonetheless, it ends up in the filtrate right here. So there is another process that can take compounds that are in the filtrate, right, and put them back into the blood. And some good examples of this would be what? Glucose and sodium and even water. All right, so going from filtrate back to the blood is what we call tubular reabsorption. All right, so I'll write it on the board in a little synopsis form, okay? Because if you don't resorb it, it ends up in urine. Okay. Now, urea that's coming in this afferent arteriole, some of it will end up in the filtrate, but some doesn't get filtered. Some still ends up in the efferent arteriole, and it's a toxic compound. You don't want to have urea in your body. So there are other kinds of transporters that can take urea that's in the blood. Remember, what is this right here? This is part of the, I'll draw it down here, part of the peritubular capillary. So if we have, for instance, urea in the blood, there are transporters that can put it into the filtrate. So this is process one. Here is two. Here is three. Right here. So let's take a look at this. What is that? One is filtration. And how does that go? How does material go for filtration? Filtrate to blood or blood to filtrate? Blood to filtrate. And where does that take place? Only in this part of the nephron, which is composed of the glomerulus and Bowman's capsule. Sometimes if we put these two together, we call that the renal corpuscle. Right? That might ring a bell. Renal corpuscle. That's where filtration takes place, right, based on the size of the molecule only. So large proteins are too big to be filtered. Red blood cells are way too big to be filtered. Unless there's damage to the nephron, then you can get blood in the filtrate, and what's that a sign of? That's nephritis, right, or an infection, right? That shouldn't happen in a normal nephron. All right, process number two. The second one, we got what? Reabsorption. And how does that go? Is that blood to filtrate? Reabsorption is filtrate, putting it back into blood, like the things that you don't want to get rid of, glucose, sodium, water. All right, so tubular reabsorption is filtrate, back into the blood. And then the third process right here, we've got tubular. Because remember, we drew all the little tubular elements right here. Tubular what? Secretion. For things that you have too much of in the blood. Like excess sodium, excess potassium, urea, for instance. So tubular secretion goes which way? Blood to filtrate. Blood to filtrate. All right. So by Monday, make sure you can draw this thing and I think I have a nice interactive exercise for you. I don't know if I have it easily available. I'm sure it's on, oh, it's on the study guide. You have a picture of a nephron in the study guide with a link underneath it. And if you hit control and click on it, it's an executable link, even though it's a Microsoft Word document. And it will take you to, this place here. The nephron. Here's a nephron coming up. You see the nephron? It's loading. All right, so here is your, here's your nephron. All right, so here's a cortical radiate artery. What do we call this vessel right here? That would be the afferent arteriole. What is this first capillary called? Glomerulus. And what is this called? Efferent arteriole. So make sure you work with this and you can draw in those three processes by Monday. Nice. That's really nice. Okay. And then we'll talk about some other things. No, not Monday. Tuesday. Okay. Yeah. I'd have a good time.